I'll talk about some work which we have been involved in the past couple of years. The latest paper is with Adel Awad, who is actually in Egypt. Archishman Ghosh and Jelu Ko are my students in Kentucky and Sandeep Trivedi in Bombay. And I'll, if I get some time, I'll talk something about some earlier work which we had done on the subject. So the idea is the following. So near singularities, we know that the equations of general relativity break down. And the big question is not to take that seriously in the sense that we know that we are actually solving equations which are not valid near the singularities. So the question is, what replaces them? And as we know, the holographic correspondences, which arise from string theory or otherwise, do provide a possible clue. Because in holographic correspondences, gravity in the bulk is an approximate description of something a little more fundamental. The slogan is, like, gravity is an emergent phenomenon. And the big question is that, can we use this description in any controlled fashion to ask what happens near singularities? So in this talk, I'm going to describe one approach which uses the ADS-CFT correspondence. There are several other approaches. In fact, it appears that two of them would be discussed later on in this conference, so I'll not talk about them. In it, I'll be using the ADS-CFT is, in fact, its simplest possible setting, namely the setting in which a 2B string theory on ADS-5 plus S-5 is dual to an N equal to 4 SUN Young-Mills theory, which is living on the boundary. And there is this crucial relationship between the dimensionless parameters of the theory, namely the length scale, the R ADS in string units is related to the Etoffe coupling of the theory. And this immediately tells you that when N is large, N of the SUN, and the Etoffe coupling is large, then R is big compared to LS, and the bulk theory may be approximated by supergravity. This is the regime when the usual notions of space and time apply. So in terms of pictures, most of the time we'll be using global ADS, which sort of looks like a cylinder. Time runs upwards. So there's some 2B closed string theory, which is living in the boundary, living in the bulk, and the standard Young-Mills theory, which is on S3 cross time, living on the boundary. The point is that with Etoffe coupling is of order 1, or even smaller than order 1, the gauge theory is still well formulated. However, the curvatures in the bulk are large compared to the string scale, and supergravity breaks down. This is the breakdown of supergravity, this particular way supergravity is breaking down, which we are trying to understand, which I'll try to understand in terms of the gauge theory. This is a useful relationship which tells you that the string scale curvature has this overall factor of e to the minus phi upon 2, where phi is the dilaton. And so clearly, when e to the phi becomes small or order 1, the string scale curvature, in fact, becomes large. Physically, this is a singularity, though in technical terms, nothing can actually diverge. But we know that we should not cross the supergravity equations when the curvature reaches the string scale. We will always take n, the rank of the gauge group, to be large but finite.
Use the pointer.
We'll always take n to be large so that we can always ignore the quantum effects in the string theory. But we need to understand the stringy effects, and that's what we are up to. Unfortunately, even though we always talk about this correspondence in terms of a correspondence between string theory and field theory. I mean, there are very few cases where we actually know either sides very well. In particular, we do not know very much about the even classical string theory in these backgrounds. So the hope is that we turn to the Young-Mills description in this regime and ask whether we can learn something about this. Of course, you don't expect that with the present knowledge about even the Young-Mills theory, that we expect that you learn something in a very general context. So we got to try to find examples where we can actually do something in some controlled fashion. We will investigate, therefore, toy models of cosmological singularities by considering the Young-Mills theory with a time-dependent Etouffe coupling. So here is a cartoon picture of how the Etouffe coupling may depend on time. As you can see that at early times, the Etouffe coupling is large and asymptotically constant, and then it starts dipping down to some small value to actually this scale multiplied by 100 or something like that. We are interested in the region when the small values of Etouffe coupling are order one or even small. What does it correspond to in the bulk? According to the standard ADS-CFT correspondence, in the bulk, this corresponds to a time-dependent dilaton, where the combination n multiplied by e to the phi, so that's the n times the string coupling, becomes small, and at some intermediate time, what makes the string curvature, the string frame curvature large in units of the string scale. We're going to start the theory at early times in the vacuum, so that we look at the simplest possible state. Though in principle, you can repeat many of the things which we are going to talk about, where that theory is in a reasonable excited state, though not in a terribly excited state. What that means is that at early times, the space-time is approximated by ADS 5 cross S5. So then we turn on this time-dependent source in the gauge theory. The time-dependent source means just the coupling constant depends on the time. The gauge theory now evolves according to some deformed Hamiltonian, which is a Young-Mills Hamiltonian, plus a small perturbation, which corresponds to the time-dependent coupling. Now, in this region, where the shaded region in this diagram, it's, of course, very hard to calculate anything in the gauge theory. The gauge theory is very strongly coupled. But that's why the EDS-CFT correspondent is there. So we were going to calculate this thing in gravity. And we're going to use the standard correspondence that turning on this particular kind of source means that we are turning on a non-normalizable dilaton mode. This non-normalizable dilaton mode is going to evolve according to the supergravity equations of motion, and it's going to produce a metric, a non-trivial metric by back reaction.
The Etouffe coupling knot. What's that condition in the supergravity?
So in so that condition n in constant means large means that we are going to ignore quantum effects. N times e to the phi is going to be gs times n basically. You know? So that's the combination that controls the coupling constant of the gauge theory. So we're going to look at a regime when that combination is going to become small.
With the 1 over n effects are the string coupling effects.
String coupling effects, that we are not going to bother about. We're only going to bother something which is going to mimic classical string theory.
But doesn't that imply a restriction on what the value of the dilaton is?
That's right. Yeah, so it's not going to become, you know, that small that where you get into a region of, you know, the very quantum effects. So, we are going to keep the n being large, but keeping g square n, I mean g Young-Mills square n, And that's the one we are going to take.
But do you include the Ramon flux in your story?
Pardon?
The Ramon flux will be part of your story?
Yeah, it will not. The Ramon flux will be kept, you know, the standard.
Yes.
So that, because n is hellfire. However, in this region where the coupling has become smaller, order one, supergravity is no longer a valid description. And that's the time when we are going to take recourse to the gauge theory. In particular, when the coupling really hits a zero, there's really going to be a curvature singularity in the bulk. And we will ask if the gauge theory can meaningfully describe time evolution beyond this time when this happens. If not, we would like to learn what is it that is precisely the problem in the gauge theory. It turns out that the most controlled way in which you can study this problem is to have a slowly varying dilaton. Because a breakdown of supergravity can be achieved when even by a coupling which is slowly varying but takes a long time to vary, so that, and whenever I say the word coupling, it means a Tuft coupling, so that at a long enough time, the coupling in fact becomes small. Of course, when I say a slowly varying coupling, there has to be a scale. The scale here is provided by the radius of the S3, which we are choosing to be just the RADS, we choose to be 1. So what we really mean, that time derivatives, all time derivatives in the problem multiplied by RADS, which is this combination, which I'll call epsilon, is always small. This means that if we take a variation over a time scale, which is R upon epsilon, that's a long time scale, the Tuft coupling can actually become a very small number. So that's a cartoon picture of what that is. Now, in the infinite past, in terms of global time, the space-time is pure radius 5 process 5 with a constant dilaton such that the string frame curvature is small in string units. The Einstein frame metric is the standard one in global ADS, and this provides the initial condition. So in terms of this picture, down below you have just ADS 5 process 5, this with a constant value phi minus infinity. The entire time evolution is provided by, if you wish, the banging the boundary by something, and this banging of the boundary is provided by a time dependence of the boundary value of the dilaton. So that provides the boundary condition. So in the regime where this makes sense, this is a standard problem of solving Einstein equations, and that's what we are going to do. So we're going to solve the coupled equations. This is the Einstein equation, and this is the dilaton equation, by expanding each of the fields in the following way. This is the expansion for the dilaton. The first term is, in fact, the boundary value of the dilaton. So if I just take phi to be phi naught of t, it's not going to solve Einstein's equation, because phi naught is a function of time. But it does solve Einstein's equation, which we ignore all time derivatives. So this will be corrected by a term which is phi 1, which is order epsilon. And similarly, the metric can be written as a sum of the zeroth order metric, which is ADS, and then a perturbation, which is order epsilon. The magnitude of the perturbations are not small. You know, the amplitudes can be as large as you wish. The only thing is all the time variations are small. This is, in fact, inspired by what is sometimes called the hydrodynamic approximations. And it's, of course, as you know, it's a very popular application of the ADS-CFT correspondence, where slowly varying fields on the boundary corresponds to a hydrodynamic approximation, and that has a nice ADS interpretation. In particular, derivatives of these objects with respect to R are not small. Only the time derivatives are small. You could have generalized the thing by talking of inhomogeneous boundary conditions, which are inhomogeneous on the boundary, We are not going to talk about that. We are just talking about the spherical symmetric mode of the theory. But I guess in that case, what it would require is that this all the derivatives with respect to the boundary directions are small, but derivative with respect to the r direction can be large. It turns out that with the lowest non-trivial order in epsilon, the solution is in fact is very simple. Since each time derivatives come with a factor of epsilon, you can do a very quick thinking and immediately realize that the first term phi 1 and the first term g 1 is going to vanish. And in fact, and this is the thing, this is the point which will become important in what follows, the equations for the fluctuations phi 2 and this GAB2, in fact, decouple. There's actually a way of understanding this, which I will come to very soon, the presence of this decouple. So what they essentially become are equations in the ADS5 cross S5 background with a source term which is provided by the dilaton. So that you can solve. I'll just give you the solutions. This is the solution.
Analysis in the following way. So you have phi naught, g naught, that doesn't satisfy the equations. So that will introduce a g1.
That's correct.
Then at second order, you'll get a phi1.
No, the reason why you don't get a phi1 is because at second order, that's right. So you'll get a phi, that's the thing which I'm calling phi2. So the definition of the phi2 and g2 are the things which involve epsilon squared. Epsilon is like a single time derivative. So that's exactly what is happening.
No.
So the fact that you introduce a time dependence in phi, that means
the reason why g1 is not vanishing because the left hand side of Einstein equations has RAB. And the right-hand side has the energy-momentum tensor of the thing. So to this, you're going to expand as phi naught plus phi 1 plus phi 2, right? But phi, the lowest term is phi naught, so that only depends on time. And it always comes as dt phi whole squared. And then there are additional terms. This itself is epsilon squared. So the leading contribution is epsilon squared. And those are the solutions for the components of the metric. I think everybody can hear me. I'm loud enough.
It's for recording.
Huh?
It's for recording.
Oh, it's for recording.
I just forgot to record.
Might as well for posterity. See, in capital R equal to 1 units, which we are going to use, these are the solutions. But there's nothing
very enlightening about logs and dialogues in the solution. What is interesting, and in fact quite expected, is that the solutions are completely smooth and they are regular everywhere to this order. In fact, what this means, the horizons are not formed when you have the slowly varying dilatons. That's not very surprising, because in fact Bhattacharya and Meenwala has done a calculation which is very similar to what I have just described, which is in a complementary regime. So what we have described is a dilaton which can be as large as it wish, but slowly varying. What these people have described is a dilaton whose amplitude is very small, but it can vary as fast or as slow as possible. So what they found is that when there's a relationship between the amplitude and the time scale of the variation of the dilaton, and when the time scale of the variation of the dilaton is small enough, there are no black hole forms, what happens is the energy is just rattling supergravity modes which are living in the bulk. In fact, we expect that when the dilaton moves fast enough, a black hole would be formed in the supergravity approximation, and that's the formation of the black hole which these people analyzed in the small amplitude limit. What does it mean in the gauge theory? In the gauge theory, what this means is that so long as the TUF coupling remains large, so that the supergravity calculation can be trusted, the energy which is pumped into the system does not thermalize, and it does not get dissipated. There's another aspect of this thing happening, and that comes when you calculate the stress tensor and the expectation value of the operator, which is dual to the dilaton, by using standard techniques of the holographic renormalization group. And these are the answers. If you look at the answer for the total energy of the system, there are two terms. The first term is just the Casimir energy of the Young-Mills theory living on the S3. The second term is a term which appears because the coupling constant phi naught, or the boundary value of the dilaton, depends on time. Note that it's proportional to phi dot square. This is the answer for the one-point function of the operator, which is dual to this dilaton mode, which is the spherically symmetric mode of the dilaton. It's actually an integral of trace F square. And that's proportional to phi double dot. These two expressions should satisfy the Noether relation, which just states that the time derivative of the energy is the phi dot multiplied by the expectation value of that corresponding operator. And one of the things this shows is that the fact that this becomes a total derivative, it means that if we always stay in the supergravity regime, nothing dramatic happens. It's in fact quite boring. It's completely smooth. And so if we could start it out with a coupling which is slowly varying and gets back to, again, a constant value, always staying in the supergravity regime, we are going to get a perfect bounce. And all the energy which was input in the system just comes out just the way it is. Of course, what else could have happened? Well, in fact, nothing else could have happened in this case. But something which is a little bit in a different setup can happen. I just wanted to point out that even with a slowly varying dilaton, other things can happen if the starting state of the system is a little bit different. So we started with a vacuum of the theory. Suppose instead of starting out with a vacuum of the theory, you started out with a thermal state, a thermal equilibrium state of the theory, and you are driving the system out of equilibrium by changing the coupling constant as a function of time. This calculation was done some time ago by these people. And what you find there is that if you calculate the change of the energy or the temperature, the time derivative of that, it's phi dot square, which is not a total derivative. So what this means is if we integrate this thing between minus infinity and plus infinity, it's this thing not being a total derivative means that the energy does not get back into the system. So if you started out with a thermal state, you put in a little bit of energy by banging the system, that energy immediately gets dissipated. The temperature of that system, in fact, rises. That doesn't happen if you start out with the vacuum state of the theory or a state which is slightly excited but not thermalized. Nothing then increases.
So it's not area back here.
Sorry, I'm confused. The formula for the rate of increase of the temperature doesn't have a T on the right hand side. So what's the temperature goes to zero limit of that formula?
I must have missed something here. Yeah, there should be some T there, actually. I must have misquoted this thing. You're right. Now, a key feature of this
above calculation, which I just described, is the decoupling of the various modes at leading order to epsilon. As I promised, this is going to play a key role when we come to the more interesting situation where we are beyond the supergravity approximation. And the reason why this happens is that we have started out with the vacuum, and we are driving the system by banging on the boundary with a force with some frequency epsilon. Now, the way we are banging the system by turning on a time-dependent coupling means it directly couples to the mode which is dual to the coupling constant, and that's a dilaton. So that's a direct coupling between that. So the dilaton gets excited. The reason why other modes of supergravity get excited in the bulk is, of course, because it's a nonlinear theory, and so the dilaton back react forms a metric. The metric, and if we go to higher orders, I mean, a lot of other things could happen. Since all these couplings typically involve derivatives of the dilaton, these couplings, in fact, are suppressed by epsilon, and we will have a more. I mean, if you just go through the supergravity calculation, you just see it right in front of you. Just this is, for example, one example why the coupling between the metric and the back reaction of the metric because of the dilaton is suppressed by epsilon. We've been talking the regime of the large Etoffe coupling, but of course we really want to know what happens when the Etoffe coupling becomes order one or smaller. In this regime of weak coupling of the gauge theory, you can do a very quick calculation of just estimate of the string scale curvature multiplied by the string length square, and you find that's the inverse of the square root of the Etoffe coupling. So when the Etoffe coupling becomes small, this thing becomes large. So this is a very stringy regime. This is what I'm loosely calling the singularity. The reason I'm calling it a singularity is not because something blows up or becomes divergent, but because the equations you are solving itself are breaking down. So it's at the first go, this is what we should try to understand.
Are modes that are important, or the string modes are important?
Yeah, that's where I come. Mm-hmm. Now, from the point of view of the gauge theory, this is actually a standard quantum mechanical problem, which you have seen in textbooks. You have a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has a parameter which depends on time. And the time dependence in slow, typically what do? Use adiabatic approximations to solve the problem. The parameter in this case is the coupling. And the other feature which is important in the problem is that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in this case is discrete, and there is a gap between the ground state and the first excited state. The gap is just provided by the inverse radius of the S3. And what this gap, in fact, ensures, according to standard textbook adiabatic approximation, is that you're going to have, basically, we start out with a ground state. The ground state, in fact, just traces itself according to the ground state of the instantaneous Hamiltonian. Now, we know that there is a gap, which is the inverse, basically, typically the inverse of the size of the S3, of course, from supergravity, because it's like ADS is like a box where you solve for the modes and there is a discrete nature. But we also know something, in fact, stronger. We know that regardless of what the value of the coupling constant of the Young-Wills theory is, and now we are talking about the spectrum of the instantaneous Hamiltonian. There's a Hamiltonian at some instantaneous value of the coupling. Because the states from a unitary representation of the conformal algebra, there's some theorem whose proof I do not know, it guarantees that there is always a gap, and that gap is exactly equal to the dimension of the free field operator, which in this case is just the lowest gauge invariant operator which you can form with free field dimensions, trace 5 square or something like that. That's always a bound. Yeah, I'll come to that, of course. That's, of course, the main point of this. So let me review a little bit textbook adiabatic approximation. One starts with a Hamiltonian, which depends on a parameter, which is a function of time. So one considers the instantaneous Hamiltonians, whose eigenstates are phi m, energies are em. They all depend on the values of this parameter. Then the adiabatic theorem implies that if this parameter goes to some constant value in the far past,
And, for example, we start out with the ground state of this Hamiltonian corresponding to that value. Then the state at some given time, t, is given by this relationship, which is basically the time evolution of this, the ground state which you started out with. Okay? The leading corrections, which can be calculated in the standard fashion, can be written in the following form. This is a sum over all the states of the instantaneous Hamiltonian except the one which you have started out with, namely the ground state. And this coefficient is given by this expression. This is the matrix element of the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to that parameter which you started out between the ground state and one of these states of the instantaneous Hamiltonian. And the most important thing is that there is a standard denominator, which is the gap between the ground state and any one of the excited states. This correction is small, provided, now in the adiabatic approximation, the first thing which you do is to take this thing to be small, bring it out of the integral and do one of these integrals. And then what you find that this is a self-consistent procedure, provided this matrix element multiplied by the time derivative is smaller than the square of the gap in the spectrum. In our case, we have Young-Mills theory on S3 of unit radius and a time-dependent coupling. And the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to that dilaton is in fact the operator, which I'll call O with the subscript of L equal to 0. It will just turn out to be an integral of trace F square. And this condition just becomes that condition. And you can easily check that this matrix element is order n. It has just got to do with the fact that the two-point functions in the theory are order n square. And this particular state is one of the states which is created by this operator itself. And if you put everything together, what you find is something which is interesting, but something which you don't necessarily like. Namely, the condition for validity of this approximation, the way it is formulated just now, is that not just epsilon is small, but n times epsilon is small. Well, n is a fixed number which you want to take very large. So this is getting into slippery grounds. But before I go further, I will, of course, address this question. Before we go further, let me just make a few comments. The adiabatic approximation, of course, has nothing to do with the value of the coupling constant. So it, of course, holds for small Itub coupling as well, though it is not a perturbation theory in small coupling. Now, if it so happens that the epsilon which you pick is so small that n times epsilon is always small, what we have again is again a perfect bounce back into ADS 5 plus S 5, the ground state of the system. It just start out and it sort of traces itself. It just follows the Hamiltonian time dependence and becomes the ground state. Well, that's one result, necessarily not the most interesting result, because what we are really interested in is a regime where epsilon is small, but n times epsilon is not small. In fact, n times epsilon can be large. I want to take n to be very large so that I don't want to bother about quantum effects in the string theory. So what do? We need to find a scheme. Namely, we want to find a scheme where the adiabatic approximation can be carried through, but which also has some kind of overlapping regime of validity with supergravity. Now, the way I've just described the adiabatic approximation, just picked up some quantum mechanics textbook, it's a good description of the states of the system in terms of the states of the gauge theory, which correspond to the bulk with a state of a finite number of particles. So the reason is that we took these operators which are dual to whatever modes are there in the bulk, and the states phi n which we chose various states which are obtained by Jenkins operator 1 times and 10 times and 20 times are acting on the vacuum. These are few particle states in the bulk. However, classical solutions are of course not that. Classical solutions do not correspond to just a few quanta on the vacuum. They correspond to lots of quanta on the vacuum. They in fact correspond to coherent states. What are these coherent states? Coherent states are coherent states. They have a description in the gauge theory in terms of states which are coherent with respect to the gauge invariant operators. So let me describe them. So here is what I would call a coherent state in the gauge theory. These are suitably defined creation parts of operators of the theory. For example, what you do is take the operator, the standard operator dual to the L equal to 0 dilaton, which is the integral of trace F square, and you write it up in terms of the time derivative t to the minus iet and to the plus iet and separate out the positive, the so-called positive and negative frequency modes. Exponentiate that together with some phase factor and act it upon the adiabatic vacuum of the theory. This is a coherent state where the expectation value of this operator itself is going to be basically this parameter lambda of t. Once you write down such a state, here is a possible way to look at the dynamics of the theory. And this is something which people have looked at in the past, in the 80s, for example. So what do? You figure out what is the algebra of these operators OI, plug this thing into the Schrodinger equation, and using this algebra, you will get some differential equations which tell you the time variations of lambda and chi. You specify some initial conditions, and you solve those.
Yeah. The operators themselves wouldn't close on, right, on themselves unless n is large.
In fact, as I said, that this is actually a program which Larry Yaffe had, in fact, sort of pursued quite a bit in large n as an approach to understand the sense in which large n gauge theory is in fact a classical theory. And that's related to your points, because when you take a classical limit of a quantum mechanical system, you just don't start with some arbitrary state of the quantum system. You start with a suitable coherent state of that system and then take the classical limit. So the question is, what are these states in the large n theory, any large n theory? These would be states which sort of looks like that. And then you sort of, you know, run your machine, use factorization formula for, you know, expectation values of operators, and hope to get something out of it. Except, in most cases, it's almost an impossible plan to implement. There are sort of indirect ways of implementing these things in large n gauge theories, which are very simple, like matrix quantum mechanics. Even then, as you know, it sort of leads to something rather non-trivial. But if you try to do this for n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory, I think good luck. That's not going to happen. However, in our situation, things actually drastically simplify, at least to the lowest order of the adiabatic approximation. And the reason is as follows. The reason, as I said, is that the non-trivial dynamics of the system which we are trying to analyze is not set by an initial state which is non-trivial. The initial state is, in fact, the vacuum state of the theory. The dynamics is entirely controlled by the beating of the boundary. And that, as I said, leads to the couplings in the bulk to be suppressed by epsilon, by powers of epsilon. Here's a quick way of seeing that from the point of view of the gauge theory. With a suitable and normalized two-point functions, so normalized operators, if I take a three-point function of some gauge invariant operator, standard large n counting rules tell you that this is of the order of 1 upon n. This is the vacuum expectation value. But if I want to take the three-point function actually in a coherent state, what I should sort of, a rough estimate of how to do that is to recognize, as we will see later on, that such coherent states have order n square epsilon square quanta. So you convert this first into a probability by squaring this up, that gives 1 upon n square, and then you multiply it by the flux, which is the number of average, the roughly the average number of quanta in such a state, and what you get is that probability epsilon square, which means effectively the three-point function is suppressed by a power of epsilon. Thus, for epsilon very small, these operators can be considered to be independent of each other with small non-linearities. Now, this is something which we saw in the supergravity analysis to leading order in epsilon anyway, but this argument tells you that that should be true in the gauge theory even when the coupling constant is not very large so that you can take recourse to supergravity for an answer. So once you get this, then you, of course, immediately realize that things become very simple. In particular, you can write this operator as a sum of basically harmonic oscillators, which are written there, with some normalization, which is fixed by requiring that this produces the known standard two-point function. Note that even though this is in the Schrodinger picture like a single operator, it has a sum over modes. And that's significant. This integer n, which is sitting here, is in fact, from the bulk point of view, a radial quantum number of the n equal to 0 dilaton. After all, the dilaton is living in one extra dimension, so it should have four quantum numbers. Three of them are provided by the angular momentums on the S3. The fourth is a radial quantum number. From the point of view of gauge theory, this n is in fact that radial quantum number. Okay. Finally, if phi naught denotes the boundary value of the dilaton, we have the Noether relation that the time derivative should be related to the operator multiplied by phi naught. So you can write down an expression like this. The calculation reduces to a calculation of a simple harmonic oscillator with a driving force, which of course you can do. So you do it. And for a state which looks like this, this is the equation you got to solve. There are two terms in this equation. The first term is just the harmonic oscillator equation, which shows us 2n was in fact the frequency of those oscillators. This is the one that gives the time dependence if nothing else was present in the system. This term is from the driving force, which is why it is proportional to phi naught dot. So you've got to solve these equations with initial conditions that these things are 0 at t equal to minus infinity, which is like saying you're starting out with a vacuum of the theory, not with some excited state of the harmonic oscillator. And using the property that this is also a function which goes to 0 at infinity, what you have is that it's a trivial equation to solve, and that's what the equation is. But that's not what we want to do. We want to take the exact solution and recast it so that the adiabatic expansion becomes obvious. So in this case, that's simple to do. So this is the exact solution. So you just do integrate. So this is a thing which is small. So what you do, the first term here is treating that, integrating this entire thing once. So this thing has come out. There's an additional power of 2in, which comes from integrating that. So then you get this, integrate that again, then you get that, and you keep doing this. So you see that clearly is an expansion in time derivatives acting on phi naught. This is the adiabatic approximation which we are seeking. Note that we have assumed that the oscillators are independent. Now, this is valid when for small values of phi naught and phi double dot. So you shouldn't take the higher terms of this thing very seriously anyway for the application of this formalism to your real problem. So let's now see what is, so we have now recast a slow approximation in a slightly different form in terms of coherent states. So let's see what is the condition for validity of this approximation. The previous expansion just showed that the condition for validity is the second derivative divided by the first derivative of I naught. There's an n there much smaller than 1, but n is like 1, 2, 3, 4, so it's sufficient to have this thing with n equal to 1, but that's precisely what epsilon is. There are two time derivatives on top, one time derivative in the bottom, so that's just 1 power of time derivative, and that's epsilon. Note that n is the characteristic frequency in the system which is quantized since the theory is living on S3. If there was no gap in the spectrum of the theory, n could be arbitrarily small, and this is always going to fail. You are never going to satisfy this condition, which is why it is very crucial that the theory always has a gap. The condition that epsilon is small is in fact precisely the condition, the regime of approximation which we used in our supergravity analysis. But however, if you want to have these states as good approximation to classical states, this is the large n part of the thing, so then this parameter lambda has to be very large. I mean, there's a hidden n there. I mean, there's a it is lambda times some operator, but the operator, normalized operator, is, you know, 1 upon n. So I think effectively 1 upon n is the coupling constant of this, if you wish, the collective theory. This condition, it's not very hard to verify, leads to the condition that n times epsilon is in fact very large. So that's good. In fact, that's the kind of regime which corresponds to taking an n which is very large and epsilon which is very small, and n times epsilon being in fact large, and that's precisely, if you remember, what we had when we did the supergravity analysis. In fact, you can use this formalism to calculate the quantities which we calculated in supergravity, and we check that up to numerical factors, they are in fact exactly what we had. The framework which we have developed, in the face of it, applies to all values of the Etoffe coupling, therefore can be extended to the regime of small couplings as well. However, as has been pointed out by various people, when the coupling gets very small, there's an infinite tower of states which become important. And this infinite tower of states, whose duals are gauge invariant operators, and they all become important because they are dual, as important as the operators which are dual to the supergravity modes. That's because, whereas at large lambda, the conformal dimensions of the higher stringy operators are order 1, while conformal dimensions of the supergravity modes are, order n, while those of the supergravity modes are order 1, for small lambda, those conformal dimensions become, in fact, comparable. So you cannot ignore this. Nonetheless, the basic ingredients which went into our coherent state adiabatic approximation are still in place. The couplings, first, the couplings between different oscillators are again suppressed by epsilon. That's a general argument. The frequencies are still order 1 for any value of the lambda, so that the system is always far from resonance, and so it makes sense to talk of the adiabatic approximation. And for n times epsilon, very large, the states are still classical. This is classical in the sense of a large n limit. This is not classical in the sense of, you know, this is the classicality of the string theory, if you wish. It would therefore appear that the version of adiabatic theorem, which I just outlined, it still holds. If it does, and I'll raise the question whether it does or not, what we will have is that as we pass through this high region of stringy, region of very high curvature, just like that, you're going to end up again with the original vacuum state of the theory. But of course, in this, just in standard any other adiabatic approximation, there are always exponentially small effects. So those exponentially small effects are there. So it's a little bit different from ADS5 plus S5, but not that different. That's what you would expect if the adiabatic approximation does hold. No, so that's a theorem, that by if you have unitary representations of the conformal group, we are talking of the just the spectrum of
the standard n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory. And that always has a gap. The gap is given by 2 units of the radius of the arm.
So I guess one thing we can go around is the degeneracy.
So right above the gap there, what happens is there are lots and lots of states. And that's what I will discuss, what that can be.
However, there is another possibility. What is this possibility? So the point is, there are order n squared stringy modes or non-chiral operators where there are only order 1 supergravity operators. Now, while individual couplings are clearly suppressed by epsilon, what can happen is that since just above the gap, there are these lots and lots of other stringy modes which are closely placed spaced with each other, there is a possibility that whatever energy that you have supplied into the system by driving the boundary can get dissipated, it can get thermalized, and there's huge number of degrees of freedom, each of them interacting weakly, but there are lots and lots of them, so you don't know. I mean, maybe they can get thermalized, and if thermalization does happen, of course, that's a one-way process, so the energy gets dissipated. So when the coupling returns back to large values, there's no way of extracting that energy. That energy stays into the system as a kind of a thermal gas or something. What happens if it does appear like that? If it does thermalize and the energy just stays back in the system? This one thing we know, that the energy is order n square epsilon square, and that's one of the things which we learned in this problem. Now, when the Etoff coupling becomes large again, then there is a supergravity description of the system. This normal spacetime has re-emerged, if you wish. We want to figure out what kind of normal spacetime we have come up with. Now, this is also the regime where you can use some standard results of ADS-CFT correspondence, which are described, for example, in the big review article, which tells you, given some amount of energy, which is in some thermalized fashion, what is the dual, or what is the dual description of that? And these are the results. So what I have done here in rewriting these results is that the energy is n square epsilon square, and these various energy regimes are known to have different things. When epsilon square is very small, much smaller than this object, now you see that n is a large number, and lambda is also a very large number now, because we have gone into the regime where lambda is large and there is a space-time. What we have is a gas of supergravity modes. So this is in the ADS-CFT, if you just excite the system and a very small amount of energy which is thermalized, then the dual is just, you know, chiral operators and supergravity which are mixed with each other, and that's what this is. When epsilon square is bigger than that amount, but less than this lambda raised to the power minus 7/2, and the way these things are usually derived is that you go to the supergravity description and, you know, compare the entropy with, you know, the entropy of various possible configurations and pick the thing of minimum entropy. So that's the way this happens. So in this regime, what we have is a gas of higher stringy modes. There's lots of strings which are thermalized in the ADS space. But when an epsilon becomes a little larger but still much smaller than 1, what you have are small black holes. These are black holes whose sizes are much smaller than RADS. So you have a situation where there are small black holes which are sprinkled in otherwise normal ADS space. When you go to even higher energies in ADS-CFT, and when the energies actually become of the order of n square, which in our case corresponds to epsilon becoming order 1, Then you have big black holes. These big black holes are, they sort of fill of sizes much larger than RADS. And so there are the things sitting there. The region outside the black hole, there's always an infinite amount of space outside that black hole. But these are the sort of qualitatively different objects than just in what you would call normal space-time. One thing we know from this analysis is that such big black holes will not form. They require an energy of the order of n square. We have energy the order of n square, epsilon square, but by making the dilatons low enough, slow enough, we can prevent the formation of big black hole. In any case, any of these three alternatives would be space-time close to ADS 5 process 5 with some little things sprinkled in it. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to determine whether in this case thermalization is going to occur or not. Thermalization is always very difficult to follow, but sometimes when there is a separation of length scales in the problem or time scales in the problem, like the interaction time scales and the time scales in which things are varying, when they are well separated, one can make a good guess, a rough statement. In this case, these two scales are in fact exactly identical. The basic scale of driving the system is again epsilon, and we figured that the interaction between these modes is also order epsilon. So this is the toughest possible situation you want to encounter if you want to determine whether there is thermalization or not. So we do not have a definite statement on this. We just list the various alternatives which that can happen. I think I've run out of time, so I'll not review this earlier work on rapidly varying dilatons. But let me just end with some comments. Most of the recent work in this area aims to arrive at toy models of cosmology, where but the aim is to, in fact, to understand the meaning and the physics of singularities in some controlled fashion. So you work in various approximations in order to just to get a handle on what this. So clearly, it's an investigation in a very, very early stage. The hope, however, is that, of course, like at all toy models in physics, I mean, and Coleman had a nice phrase that you talk about these toy models, which are caricatures of the real thing, but it should be a recognizable caricature. So if it is a recognizable caricature, you would expect that it will eventually, I think, teach us something about real cosmology. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah. So far, the singularity you've described is one where you get stringy curvatures and everything is controlled by what you might call classical in the sense of space-time H-bar, but from string theory. So do you think that'll teach you something about like the sort of velocity-dominated singularities you see in actual cosmology? Because there it seems like the Planck scale is really important.
Yeah, so yet in Planck theories, everything is fine. Yeah. So, yeah, I doubt it. I think... I think our main purpose was to say something a little more definitive about a region where supergravity has nothing to say. Okay.
Right. Sure.
It appears from this framework that if you want to really understand Planck scale effects, then you've got to do with finite engaged fields in one way or the other. The other possibility is that what is a string scale effect in lower dimensions can be a Planck scale effect in higher dimensions. Okay. It's like in M theory, everything is Planck scale, so there may be certain class of things in M theory can be understood.
Well, you can imagine there's some sort of masking where you hit the string scale and you get no further.
Yes, that's right.
So you were saying that whatever the parameter that changes that excited states also control the thermalization, they're both controlled by epsilon.
Right.
So if epsilon is zero, there is no thermalization.
That's right. But if epsilon is zero, there's nothing. But this is just ADS.
Yeah. Isn't it better if you add another parameter that controls the thermalization? I mean, that sounds more realistic.
Yeah, I agree with you. So there is, the point is that the framework in which have our aim was to have this framework go to a place where you can address stringy departure from supergravity and understand this in the fullest possible extent. You're right, in order to understand a situation where things do thermalize or not, you probably need another parameter, something. I guess if you could do with finite n, that could be, you know, one example where that would happen, because that is 1 upon n is the coupling. Okay, so, but...
What was the problem with doing the Wernicke expansion around the door?
So the problem of going to next to leading order in 1 upon n is that then these operators don't factorize, and then it becomes a lot more complicated.
Can you just do perturbation theory in 1 upon n?
Possibly you can. I think it's going to be rather complicated. I mean, not conceptually, but... Mm-hmm. Yes?
So one of the possibilities you mentioned is that you form many small black holes.
Right.
Which also have space-like singularities in them.
That's right. That's right.
So what happens there?
I have nothing to say about that at the moment.
Also, when you,
Albioni is going to talk a little bit about that.
When you say small, what
smaller than the RS. These are essentially 10-dimensional black holes rather than 5-dimensional black holes. Yeah.
So you're describing a string theory solution where quantum effects, genus effects are negligible, and
that's right.
Alpha prime effects are finite but of order 1. The conventional wisdom would have been that such a solution should be describable by a non-trivial world sheet in formal field theory, where you just disregard variables.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you expect that there should be such a thing? And shouldn't that be somehow easier than doing the whole idiosyncrasy analysis?
If we did, but when I look at Barkovic's papers, I get very scared. Because of the Ramon flux and all that. You're absolutely right.
I
think the whole world is waiting to have a good worksheet formulation of string theory with Ramon fluxes. Many problems will become very easy at that point. Problem of quark confinement.
Okay, so let's then sum it together.
Thank you. I had a thank you.